from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, Senior Fellow and Executive Director Emeritus of the George Lucas Education Foundation, Milton Chen, will join us in studio, along with Tina Bersagian, who is now in charge of a new KQED website dedicated to education and technology issues. We'll discuss a range of issues with them related to education in this digital era of growing class sizes, teacher layoffs, and rapidly diminishing budgets. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. With students going back to school, we thought we would use this forum hour to discuss a number of education issues, especially related to innovation and the changing nature of education and educational resources in these difficult and digital times. Joining us in studio is Milton Chen, an old friend of ours who worked at KQED for many years. In fact, Milton sent an email recently, said he reminded us that he was once teaching us how to use email around here. Now, he's Senior Fellow and Executive Director Emeritus of the George Lucas Educational Foundation and was founding director of KQED's Center for Education, and has published a book called Education Nation, Six Leading Edges of Innovation in Our Schools. Good to see you. Welcome.
Great to be back, Michael.
Glad to have you home. Tina Bersagian is also here with us in studio. She is editor of MindShift. That's a new KQED website that covers education and technology. You can go to MindShift at kqed.org and find out all about it. She's also former editor of Edutopia, which was a magazine for teachers and really focused on best practices in education. And welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations to both of you on the book, on the blog, and let's begin with, since both of you are so involved in new technology, and we'll talk about some of the specifics of that and how new technology works pedagogically and how it enhances and can be used to enhance education. I just happened to come across an article by Robert Samuelson where he said, you know, the real problem is with pedagogy and with education, kids aren't motivated. He quotes Michael Kirst, among others, of Stanford, and he says, motivation is weakened because more students of all races and economic classes, let it be added, don't like school, don't work hard, and don't do well. And I found myself thinking, well, unfortunately, there may be a good deal more than a grain of truth to that. So does all of this digitalization and all of these iPods and all of these things that we now have helping us, remote learning and so forth, does it get to the problem of motivation? Milton, what do you think?
I certainly believe so. And if you look at the way in which young children are using these new digital devices, starting in the preschool ages all the way through elementary school into high school, this is their medium. We have this phrase of digital natives, and these kids are born digital. This is their medium, their way of learning, and they're very motivated by it. I was just saying in the green room that Oregon is the only state that has brought its entire testing online. It's the same test. It's the same paper and pencil test. But by bringing it online, they can do all sorts of things in terms of providing better test administration. But the kids like to take the test more. So they persist more. They answer more questions. Whereas with the paper and pencil test, they get tired. They're not interested. But I do believe that the motivational aspects of technology, just as we saw with the motivational aspects of television in the founding of Sesame Street, we need to take this technology, this new medium, and turn it towards educational purposes and take advantage of the motivational power of it.
That's funny you mentioned Oregon. I thought you were going to mention Maine, because Maine happens to be one of the few places where there's been some testing, at least on outcomes of technology-enabled learning, and they're positive.
Yes, and the important lesson in Maine is that it's one-to-one. As Seymour Papert from the MIT Media Lab has said over and over again, the magic only really happens when it's one-to-one. As long as students have to share a computer with four or five other students, which is the average student-to-computer ratio, of course, they're not going to get enough time, they can't make it their own, they can't personalize their learning. So the magic happens when it's one-to-one, and Maine is still, unbelievably, 8 years later, the only state where you can walk into that state and every student in the middle school grades has their own laptop computer. And Maine, I just looked it up, has a population of 1.3 million people. It's the size of two San Francisco. So why can't more districts and more areas look at this and learn from Maine?
Well, what they say about that usually is too costly, too much professional training, and so forth. And you've crunched some figures here, and they don't sound all that high. $250 a year price tag on student and teachers getting laptops and hardware and software and internet access and teacher development, that sounds pretty cheap. It almost sounds, frankly, like something in Ripley's Believe It or Not cheap.
Well, let's acknowledge that technology, while we talk about it and we debate it and we look at the pros and cons, technology just continues to move ahead and get better and better and faster and cheaper and cheaper. So that number from Maine, $250 per student per year for everything, hardware, software, professional development, broadband internet access. Again, Maine is the size of two San Franciscos. We can't afford not to do it now while technology, you know, we've debated this for the last decade and more. Technology has just gotten to the point where it is very inexpensive. And even California, with its per pupil spending at about, I think it's $8,500 per year, many states spending $10,000 or $12,000 per student per year, we cannot afford not to do it.
Again, Milton Chen is Senior Fellow and Executive Director Emeritus of the George Lucas Educational Foundation. He's taught at Harvard. He actually worked with Sesame Street, and he's founding director of KQED's Center for Education and author of Education Nation, Six Leading Edges of Innovation in Our Schools. Tina Bersagian, I said, is editor of MindShift. It's a new KQED website covering education and technology. And I was looking on MindShift and got all these new back-to-school apps and back-to-school podcasts. And what do these have to do with motivation and learning? How do they help?
Well, it's just a different way of engaging students on their own level. As Milton mentioned, kids are digital natives, and educators are finding ways to reach them on the level that they are already very familiar with and well-versed. So the apps, for example, in terms of organizing their homework, in terms of listening to podcasts of lectures that were on, you know, that were performed on MIT, OpenCourseWare, all those different things that engage students on their own level, educators can use to actually engage them.
There's even an algorithm that tells them which classes they should cut. I mean,
that's right. That was a post yesterday, exactly, to skip or not to skip a college class. It calculates the algorithm of how many, for example, it asks you questions such as how many classes there are, when is your next quiz, is attendance being taken, and based on your answers, it gives you a response whether you should go to that class or skip it.
So with all this digitalization and everything going on online, and I'm a co-author of a textbook, textbooks becoming obsolescent, is that what we're seeing happening?
I think eventually it's going to get to that level. I think it's just a period of transition right now where some school districts have wholeheartedly embraced it and some school districts are not there yet for a lot of different reasons. But I think ideally we want to get to a place where digital textbooks are not just the text thrown up on the screen, you know, in PDF form, but they're actually interactive and children and students can engage with them on a deeper level.
Now, when you were editor at Edutopia, you went to a lot of schools and you found out pretty much canvassed a lot of teachers in terms of what they want in terms of new technology and new equipment. What are they asking for and what do they need to be trained in?
What they want and what they need are kind of
two different things.
Yeah. I think everybody wants at least one computer for their classroom, and that's not a reality yet. But even with just one computer in a classroom, although that's not ideal, a teacher can take advantage of creating, for example, blogs for their students, creating an open source wiki where she can post assignments and have kids respond. They can create digital stories. They can create podcasts, all manner of ways that they can use just even the one computer in the class.
Well, Milton Chen, you're talking about not only all the new equipment and new technology, you're talking about different ways of rearranging curriculum, a push for major reform, really, learning in the afternoons and the evenings and on weekends, sorts of things that teachers you think are open to?
Well, I think we're learning now that that learning can be 24/7, and learning doesn't have to be limited to the school schedule. Schools have operated on a 6x5x180 schedule, where it's 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 180 days a year. We're just coming out of summer vacation, which we now know is 3 months of time when some kids move ahead. They are surrounded by learning experiences that often their families can provide for them, whether it's camp or lessons. But a lot of kids fall back, and that summer learning loss in reading and in mathematics affects kids that generally come from lower-income backgrounds where their parents cannot afford for them to have these experiences. So we are seeing a whole movement around summer learning, around taking advantage of the afternoon time, all the time that kids have, really. Every hour, every week, every month, every year can be a learning hour or a learning month. So we're looking at after-school hours and making sure that kids can now get more learning time. I mean, it's an anachronism that kids are out of school for 3 months. You know, it goes back to the agrarian time when, I don't know about you, Michael, but my daughter's never really brought in the crops during the summer, and that's how it happened. And now we're seeing that kids can be learning around the clock and around the year.
Yeah, but my kids said they wanted their summer vacation. they would say, oh, I worked hard in school 9 months out of the year, the whole gestation, you know, I want these 3 months off.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be just, again, the sitting in class and recitation and memorization. In fact, I have a colleague, Milt Goldberg, who likes to say that, you know, a lousy 8-hour day is worse than a lousy 6-hour day. We want to have kids get those experiences in nature. I talk about that in Education Nation. We want to have experiences with other kids, with history, exploring. I mean, here we are in the San Francisco Bay Area that's so rich in museums and history. We want kids to know where they're from.
What do you think about, I mean, the traditional field trips notwithstanding, what do you think about community service?
I think it's a great thing. And service learning is also one of those edges of innovation that I talk about, that kids can provide service in their communities as well as learn. I talk about a high school senior, Luis from Oregon, who was part of a 4-H club, which speaks to the role of community organizations in forming this new day for learning, community organizations and youth development workers partnering with teachers. But he and his team from Cornelius, Oregon, did what he called a street tree inventory. And when he mentioned that, I said, what was that? He said, a street tree inventory. They monitored the health of trees in their city. And when you get into it, you learn that trees play a vital role in the public health of cities and towns. And they took digital devices, did photography, were trained by arborists to analyze the health of those trees, and created a whole database for their city about the street trees that were there. So they provided real service, and they learned a lot.
Chris, when I asked you that question, it was an open-ended question. You realize there are some libertarians who say this should be voluntary. You shouldn't impose specific activities. Like maybe somebody doesn't like trees and thinks there's all tree hugging, and why should students be required to go out and do something like that?
Well, the great thing about this new age of learning is choice for students. We want students to have more choice over their own learning, how it happens, how they learn, what they learn. And teachers who understand this, who know about the multiple learning styles of their students, can address students in different ways, and technology, you know, can enable students to express what they know in different ways. Maybe some students are more verbal and excel at writing. But some students, like George Lucas, are more visual and can make films and use images to express what they know. So there's a great deal of choice and liberation, I'll put it that way. I wanted to call my book The Liberation of Learning because knowledge is now liberated, and students and teachers should be liberated to make more choices about what they learn and when they learn it.
And again, Milton Chen is a senior fellow and executive director emeritus of the George Lucas Education Foundation. Tina Barsegian now is editor of MindShift, a new KQED website that covers education and technology issues. And I was reading, a couple things on the blog. One was the fact that cyberbullying, this came out of the Washington Post, I guess, is more common among girls. I mean, it's a different variety, but it's more of a problem where girls are concerned.
That's right. I read the same article and I posted it online because I was fascinated by that. They don't actually get to the reason why that is. And so I put it out there to the audience, and I would love to hear back from anybody who might know about that.
We'll get some opinions from listeners.
I'm sure we will.
But it's a different kind of bullying, too, we should say, between genders, yeah?
That's right. It's a different kind of bullying, whereas I think for girls, it's mostly taunting about social, kind of social circles. And I think from the boys' perspective, it's more sort of more aggressive insult. So it's much more out in the open. I think from the girls' perspective, it's much more sort of subtle and insidious.
Well, some would say technology has enabled a lot more bullying. These are the darker sides of the kind of technology we're hallowing here to some degree, both of you are. And I'm reminded also of my friend Theodore Roszak, the author of The Making of a Counterculture and a number of other books. That was his most famous, who said that the new technology is not good for creativity. I know we're getting into a can of worms here where both of you are concerned, but Roszak made a pretty strong case for that way back when this whole age began to usher in. Yeah.
I guess my response to that would be technology has allowed, has actually democratized creativity in a way for everybody so that anybody can create a website out of nothing. Anybody can create a magazine out of nothing. Anybody could create a podcast and share their information. The apps on cameras. You can make art with the beautiful apps that our iPhones come with or you can purchase. So I actually disagree with that.
Well, there's a lot of great stuff. It's a terrific tool. It also, so the argument goes, divides our attention through making us practice more multitasking. But a lot of young people, the concern is that young people, you're talking about cyberbullying, a lot of young people use the internet for games and porn.
Sure.
As opposed to using them for all these wonderful educational purposes.
But there are also those who use it for wonderful educational purposes as well. So I think the way to look at it is that the technology is the tool. If kids want to find porn, they're going to find porn, whether it's online or on a magazine.
Well, talk about the I wanted you to talk a little bit about SciTable because I didn't know much about it and I saw it on your blog. This is a mobile online science resource, and it's also a social network for students.
Yeah. That's right.
They'll use Facebook, but they won't use this, perhaps. But.
Well, they might use this, and especially if they're able to come up with a Facebook app for Citable. Basically, it's an incredibly rich resource for both educators and students about scientific topics. So almost every category has been explored. There are scientists who contribute on the site. They post their research. Students can go on and access all of that information, including video and animation. And teachers can, this is my favorite part, they can build virtual classrooms for their students by adding videos and articles and all the research information that they find on this site and assign it to their kids as part of the curriculum.
Milton, I'm sure you've heard the argument in these tough times with shrinking budgets for equipment and supplies. Teachers have to put money often out of their own pockets to buy supplies and everything. Just can't afford all this kind of fancy new technology, even if it does bring in new ways of learning and great new pedagogical tools.
Well, I'm an advocate for really looking at how money is spent and really doing kind of a zero-based budgeting approach. When we have $8,500 per student here in California, are we making sure that it's all really being well spent? And again, when we're spending $150 per textbook in California, when you look at the cost of technology, the declining cost of technology, and the richness and the wealth that it can bring to students, you'd have to argue that this is a much better investment. At the same time, I do believe that we need to catch up with other states and increase funding for education. I believe that the cost of technology isn't really the issue. It's really the development and training of teachers to understand how to use it.
Well, PCs are cheaper than ever, we should note, of course.
Yeah. Walk into a Best Buy and you'll see the power of these devices. And again, if they were to be purchased in bulk for districts and for students in California, you'd get an even cheaper price.
You can go on your blog, Tina, and learn text language, too. It is kind of a different language. I didn't know what 511 was.
I didn't either until I looked at that site. It's good to know. 511, oh my goodness, it could mean anything, but text language means too much information.
TMI.
Exactly.
But I mean, these sort of signifiers on texts, I mean, you know, you want parents to look out for things like cyberbullying. You want them to look out for porn and so forth and use whatever measures they can. But there's that whole language that they don't understand. Kids are talking a language they don't understand.
That's right. And so these websites and apps actually translate that for them. And I think it's so important for parents to stay on top of that so that they could be in their children's lives and they could engage them on their own level and understand what they're going through so that they could help them when it comes to tough times.
Well, what about the sort of things, as long as we're talking about technology, that you also have on your blog with cameras and GPSs tracking school buses in Detroit, that sort of thing? I mean, it's probably going to be part of our future.
It looks that way. Yeah, so it turns out that a lot of school districts are instituting these kinds of GPS devices with kids, which is
a tracking system.
Systems, yeah, exactly. So they swipe a card when they enter a bus and they swipe it when they descend. But also here in Richmond, California, preschoolers are wearing clothing that have, tracking chips in them, chip devices to take attendance, that's easier for attendance to keep track of them, whether they've eaten lunch and all of this. So, yeah, that seems to be how it's going.
How else is it going? Or Milton Chen, how ought it to go? I mean, again, we want to enhance education for the young. Above all, we want it to be as optimal as it can be. And you've got all these different edges. Let's talk about maybe a hierarchy of where you want to place your emphasis.
Well, for many years, people would ask us at Edutopia, you know, what is your agenda? And certainly it includes things like project-based learning and a more comprehensive approach to assessment. It includes things like teacher development to understand and practice these new innovations. But if there's one really succinct way of saying what we stand for and what my book is about, it's just four words and an equal sign. And it's just that school life should become more like real life. If school were not such an artificial environment for students, if they could do the kind of learning that people do outside of the school building, in their professions, sometimes in their after-school activities, if they could get out in the community more and connect what they're learning in school to community issues and bring what they know outside of school into their school learning. This is something that John Dewey advocated for more than 100 years ago. So that's really, when you look at the work at edutopia.org and in my book at Education Nation, there's lots of stories about kids beginning to act like scientists or think like writers or use computer-aided design to begin to work like architects. That's what we want to see happening in schools.
And a lot of that suggests a kind of more student-centered as opposed to teacher-centered, perhaps. Or, I mean, how important is it ultimately to have that forceful, inspiring classroom teacher, especially when we're going so digital with all these new apps, et cetera?
It's a totally different role for teachers, especially for teachers who are prepared in the 50s and 60s. But we now see that there's this well-known phrase that teachers shouldn't be the sage on the stage, but the guide on the side. So the new role for teachers, and I encourage teachers in your faculty meetings to try to write the new job description for the 21st century teacher. It's not so much what you know, because the knowledge and information now is on the internet, but it's how you organize your classroom, and especially the social and emotional learning part, the motivational part that teachers can play for their students. And George Lucas said it very well. He said that this is something that no computer will ever be able to do, to give you a pat on the back, tell you, Tina, you've done a really good job. You're really good at this. Keep going. That human connection, the human touch, is something that needs to go along with the high touch of the technology.
No, that's very well said. And you may have some things to say here. In fact, you may have questions or comments, and you're welcome to bring them into the conversation here and join us. Our toll-free number is available to you, so please do feel free to join us now. It's 866-733-6786 as we talk about education and what my old friend George Leonard called education in ecstasy, maybe, or education in technology. Our toll-free number again, 866-733-6786. You can also send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. We'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about education in this hour, this era of teacher layoffs and growing class sizes and shrinking budgets for equipment and supplies and school districts being forced to be quite cautious about investments in technology. We're finding out about some of the most promising and cost-effective uses of media and technology in the classroom and really talking about the efficacy of pedagogy and new innovations with Tina Barsagian, who is editor of MindShift. That's a new KQED website that covers education and technology. It also covers cultural and technological trends, research and educational policy, and certainly is out there for you to learn a great deal more from. MindShift.kqed.org is where you can find it. She's also former editor of Utopia, which is a magazine for teachers, no longer in publication, but really all about the best practices of education. Milton Chen is senior fellow and executive director emeritus of the George Lucas Educational Foundation, the author of a new book called Education Nation, Six Leading Edges of Innovation in Our Schools. And Milton was founding director of the KQED Center for Education and, taught at Harvard and also was involved. What did you do with Sesame Street, Milton? I never did find that out.
This is how I got launched on this career. I was in college, and I happened to go to the right school for the wrong reason. I was at Harvard, and I thought I was a pre-law student, but I met a professor of education who had been the curriculum advisor to Sesame Street, and we started watching kids watch television. And I worked on a show called The Electric Company, which has now been reborn on PBS and on the internet. But I began to see that kids can learn using television, the boob tube. They could, if it was adapted for positive purposes, they could learn the motivational power of that experience, and they could also learn a lot more earlier than we thought. Sesame Street started out teaching kids to count from 1 to 10, 3-year-olds. And a lot of preschool educators said, well, that's not going to work. We're having trouble doing that with kids in kindergarten. How are you going to do it? Well, today, Sesame Street, the curriculum teaches kids to count from 1 to 40.
Yeah, now Sesame Street's had a great deal of success. Of course, you remember all the debates, though, and the controversy. It moves too quickly, and kids need to concentrate more and focus more and so forth. What do you have to say about that now?
Well, actually, if you look at the length of segments on Sesame Street, and I was there when we were doing these analyses, some of them are much longer. If you look at the street scenes, there are some short bits and there are some long bits. The short bits run several minutes at most, and then there's some very short bits.
So they've lengthened the bits, so to speak.
Yes, right? And there have always been longer and shorter segments on Sesame Street.
Let's go to our callers, and we'll go first to you, Dean from Morgan Hill. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Michael made a real good point about creativity. Creativity on a computer is basically in two dimensions, but what about creativity in three dimensions? Sculpture, using a hammer, a screwdriver, being able to tie a knot, being able to solve problems, being able to see them in three dimensions, I think, is a large part of that. Granted, computers can be very creative, but what about just being able to use your hands to do the things you need to do? I would be interested in your guest comments.
All right, Milton or Tina, just step up to the plate.
I make a big point in my book of a lot of either-or debates that go on in education, that it's either, in this case, two dimensions versus three dimensions, when in fact we need to move to a more hybridized version of our educational thinking, both and. So technology, computers can be very helpful in promoting creativity and allowing kids to express their creativity. It helps a lot when they have teachers and parents who can support them in that and show them the discipline of the arts, for instance, or music. But to look at how kids are creating digital music or films on YouTube, Clay Shirky at NYU has a great piece on TED, a TED Talk, in which he says, let's just take a deep breath, because we are alive during the period of the greatest expansion of human creative capability in human history. Kids, adults are doing photography, music with the aid of digital tools. And to the 3D point, kids can create things in kind of a 3D-like environment on technology. Technology is really moving towards 3D and then see that object created. So I'm also a firm believer that kids need to learn how to use their hands too. So I will agree with most of every point that's made, but it has to be in conjunction with other things.
You're an enthusiast of both ways.
I am an enthusiast for learning.
And in fact, speaking about either or options, here's a listener who writes, I would suggest that if using a mouse instead of a pencil makes a critical difference in willingness to persevere on a test, this is proof that motivation really is lacking, perhaps pandering to a population with a diminishing attention span and an expectation of being entertained at school shortchanges students by reinforcing the mistaken impression that learning doesn't require concentration and effort.
Well, these are a lot of the debates that go on. And I am, as you said, an enthusiast for student engagement. I'll put it that way. That technology is something. These tools are ways of getting kids engaged. And that's the big hurdle. The first big hurdle is getting kids interested in the topic. And if they can learn using internet simulations or digital devices, or I talk about a great new project in just north of San Diego, where they're using the iPod Touch especially, to help kids achieve reading success at fourth grade reading. This is the first big hurdle that kids need to get to, and we're failing at that. So by kids recording themselves reading, they can listen to themselves read and improve their reading performance. This is something that technology was meant to do, to replay their performance over and over again.
I mentioned Mike Kirst before, whom I'm sure you know and who's been on this program many times, emeritus education professor at Stanford. And I also alluded to an article by Robert Samuelson. And Professor Kirst is quoted in this article as saying that, estimating that 60% of incoming community college students and 30% of freshmen at four-year colleges need remedial reading and math courses. And that's a staggering statistic. But Samuelson also says that from 1970 to 2008, student population increased 8%, while the number of teachers rose 61%. So the student-teacher ratio has actually fallen from 27-1 in 1955 to 15-1 in 2007. And he goes on to make the point that no one has really discovered transformative changes in curriculum pedagogy, especially for inner-city schools. I'm not trying to sound, you know, like Cassandra here with notes of despair or anything, but we have to really factor all of these things in when we're talking about moving in the directions that you're talking about, which are brave new world.
We need a new way of achieving success in learning. And if you look at the fourth grade reading levels of American students over the past 30 years, we've essentially made no progress. To me, that means we're using tools that are outmoded. It's very difficult for kids, most kids, to learn to read just staring at the page. But we have all sorts of new technologies where the computer can help you. If you encounter a word, it can give you a little clue. It can show you a picture. It can, if you're an English language learner, show you that word in another language that you may know. It can link to articles that you can read online. So the new multimedia learning systems that are coming out can help kids learn at a faster rate. But we have not, I like to say, it's not the students who are failing to learn. It's the system that's failing the students. We're using tools that have not worked for many years.
Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll bring in a caller named David. David, welcome. You're on.
Hey, how are you, Michael, and your guest? You know, I used to work a lot in the courthouses, and this sounds sort of similar to what the courts have had to deal with when the patents change substantially over the years, whether the costs of a service contract overwhelm the institution. So, in other words, in the old days, court records used to be on a certain format, or actually paper in the big file cabinets, and then they came up with microfiche, or there were a variety of different things. And so the courthouses used to come up with a service contract, like a 20-year contract. Well, now, we remember the days of .com when in 6 months' time, everybody would be outmoded. And so that was somewhat bankrupting our institutions, 10 years ago, and some of this is still continuing. So I'm just wondering, are the schools ending up with these massive service contracts that have to be paid off even though the technology changes too quickly? And so, for example, the education of the kids is based upon a certain budgetary pronouncement, but then all of a sudden the technology changes. You end up with these new gizmos, almost, the Music Man buying the band's band equipment for the kids in the poor town.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how much of this exists. And
David,
to go through retraining too many times.
Tina Barsegian was sort of shaking her head no here. So, you have some thoughts about what David's bringing up?
Well, no, it's not that I disagree. I think school districts across the country are finding it hard to find a way to adopt standards when it comes to these kinds of innovations. Obviously, funding is a huge issue, but also there's the whole idea of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which stops schools from providing access to the internet or, you know, blocking a lot of websites in schools. So there are a lot of obstacles in the way of having this, you know, this revolution kind of take over.
And David, we thank you for your call. I want to get more callers on here. And Daniel, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a teacher, actually, in elementary school, and I have my master's in teaching. And one of the things I've noticed is that there seems to be an overemphasis of technology use in middle school and high school instead of a concerted effort to put technology into the elementary level schools, especially kindergarten, first grade, second grade, where it's been proven time and again that it can have a dramatic impact. And I'm realizing more and more that beyond the funding and training issues with that, of course, districts having contracts that they're forced into and can't afford to pay, that it seems to be a reading issue as a stumbling block. All the content requires reading, and these grades are not quite there yet. So I'm wondering what possibilities there are for that.
Well, one of the projects I talk about in Education Nation is this iRead project. It's a new project, just 3 years old, in two districts in Canby, Oregon, and also Escondido, California. But you'll see there the use of the iPod Touch for reading and how it totally transforms this approach. Kids are reading e-books. These are mostly English language learners in this district just north of San Diego. And to the point about student motivation, when I walked into this classroom, if you did not know these kids were English language learners, the excitement and the sharing and the willingness and enthusiasm for reading was apparent. And that's what you want to see in an elementary school classroom. I will make the bet that some of these tools can accelerate kids' learning. For instance, making 1.5 years worth of progress in 1 year. That's the goal, to get these kids who are behind grade level to grade level and beyond.
Let me thank the caller. And I wonder if you agree with this listener, Milton Francis from Sonoma writes, one of the introductory comments was that youth are not motivated and won't work hard. That was me quoting Robert Samuelson. Perhaps a reference should be whether they will work smartly rather than hard. My girls chose independent studies due to the time the teacher spent disciplining other students. They worked at their pace and met with their teacher weekly to turn in projects and papers. Is it possible that the bricks and mortar school doesn't work well for all students? Is there a logical way to include virtual classes at high school, as with college courses? Freeing teachers and students from the time frame of the traditional day may help students work more effectively. Naturally, there are students who need the structure of a standard classroom and aren't disciplined enough to work effectively from outside the class, but many students can. The day of boxing students into the same mindset should be over.
Certainly, looking at the dropout rate for high school students, you'd have to acknowledge that the bricks and mortar schools are the large industrial style comprehensive high school with thousands of kids is not working. And
so
I like,
University of Phoenix is going to be our model?
Well, I like, for instance, some of the state initiatives. We have one here in California called UC College Prep. The UCs looked at high school students, to your point earlier, Michael, coming onto UC campuses and not having the quality of preparation they'd like to see so they can really take a freshman-level course, the need to remediate, spend a semester or a year remediating. So UC College Prep aims to give students online courses where no such course exists in their high school. And we still have a tremendous job to level that playing field, to make sure that every student gets access to the same courses. And online courses are filling that need for some students where the question is not if they have the course, but they have no course at all.
Another listener, Christine, writes, if anyone is going to talk about the whole picture of using technology in our schools, you also have to talk about the necessity for play. Actual physical play. One educator, Joseph Chilton Pierce, author of Evolution's End, points out how necessary play is to brain development. Those conversations have to go hand in hand for students of all economic levels. I think she's right. I think play is very important in education at all levels. And let me go to more of your calls. Richard joins us. Morning, Richard.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Couple of things. If anybody's really interested in the model between computers and school, just take a look at the state of Maine. We've had a laptop program going on for years now. Every student in Maine is provided a laptop that they can take home and work with. Second thing, as far as reteaching teachers for the new century, I was on a governor's task force in Maine. We looked at gender disparity. That's a major issue when you're talking about literacy. We need to go back to single-sex classrooms in some areas, but we also need to prepare teachers to be sensitive to that. I know a lot of teachers that go through all the way up to their master's degree that still don't have a clue about gender disparity and boys falling behind. So, and then the other thing is that everybody always ends a conversation with, we need, you know, we need math and math and science. That really has to kind of stop. I mean, look around and see where math and science has gotten us for all these years. Yeah, it's great, but we've totally abused the arts programs. Kids have no clue about interaction on projects, things like that. You know, I used to teach at Antioch College. Antioch College was a great liberal arts college. It's gone now. So
you talk about Antioch and Yellow Springs or Antioch,
right, yeah,
West
Antioch
Coast?
And Yellow Springs. Yeah. So this whole thing about math and science, you know, we have technology that's so far beyond our capability to even handle it right now. Why the hell do we need more?
Well,
let's use what we have and get back to teaching kids how to function as far as how to interact, how to use their memory, the 3D world, which is a great model. The kids that are in trouble, that's what they need. They don't need access to the web necessarily. They need to have somebody that will spend the time and be patient with them and work with them in order to move them forward.
Now, you certainly make some interesting points, Richard. I just we'll get a response from Milton or Tina, but I'm wondering why the advantage of same-sex classrooms? I mean, if boys are getting shortchanged, are they going to do better if they're divided and as you see it, into all-boys classrooms? I mean, the caller's gone, but that's, I think, what he was implying. Some response from either of you, both of you?
Well, I would you know, bring up Milton's point about why does it have to be either or? Why can't it be sort of both and? I think that technology enables creativity in ways that the previous generation doesn't really understand that well. And I think something that's really fascinating about this trend is that these Web 2.0 tools, these Wikipedias, the Ning sites where anybody could contribute anything to the site, are collaborative in nature, and anybody can participate. And that actually does provide this social interaction. These groups of kids together are creating something. And the teacher is part of that process as well. They're standing, you know, next to them and helping them through it, but they're also, you know, coaches and guides to how to use it.
Well, you mentioned Wikipedia, and, you know, it is a collaborative, collective effort.
Yeah.
But it's also subject to some real serious errors. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, facts, the Internet is also subject to all kinds of serious errors. Of course, so are classroom teachers, for that matter. But Wikipedia particularly has had some real problems in that whole dimension of people putting out information that was misinformation, that was wrong, just dead wrong, because they weren't authorities, really, and they weren't scholars, and yet they were taking on that kind of mantle of responsibility.
Yes, and I think that's a really interesting point you make. I spoke to Jeff Livingston, and I think I put up his interview today on my website. He's the senior vice president of McGraw-Hill Education Group, and I asked him exactly that same thing. And he, you know, this was his response, if I can read it. He says, I think the stress around the manipulation of information is the demise of the all-knowing expert. Today, we understand that the crowd is smarter than any individual can be. We have to prepare students to live in a world that is the understanding. And he says, the idea that the Encyclopedia Britannica is codified gospel of all information is gone, and it's not coming back. And so
I trust the Encyclopedia Britannica perhaps more than I would Wikipedia. Yeah. But, I mean, in fact, I know I would.
But Wikipedia is a good place to start, at least, for your resources, for any kind of research that you're doing. Of course, one thing that we would want to teach children is, okay, so this is a great place to start. You have these sources. Now follow up and, you know, get the statistics, just as any journalist would, from the Society of, you know, Professional Journalists, for example, or National Education Association. So the idea is that it's a starting place, but that it requires more research and detail.
Well, we're going to not require, but involve more of our callers in this program. Joe from Morro Bay, good morning.
It's Jim, but thank you for taking the call.
Jim.
Your program is great.
Thank you.
Comment, I'm somewhat familiar with the work of Adele Simon, a pretty famous educator in Canada, and she emphasizes that the greatest growth of the prefrontal cortex is achieved through play, not working in a library, not playing with computers, but real physical play. And so I know that there's been some discussion of this so far, but I'd like the panelists to address that and its importance in overall education. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. Well, we're back to play again, Milton Chen.
It's so important, and I certainly don't want to, in this program, appear to be an advocate for technology for technology's sake. In Education Nation, I talk a lot about the importance of getting kids into nature. This is one thing that technology has done by creating this virtual environment around kids that they can live in 24/7. They're not experiencing the natural physical environment around them, and so much great learning and creativity can happen in nature. I'm serving on a National Park Service advisory board where we are really elevating the role of education in the national parks, giving kids experiences, residential experiences in the national parks. And then when it comes to learning about nature, hopefully using photography, digital devices to measure and learn. We alluded to GPS and geographic information systems. Once you're learning about nature, you're back into learning to use technology for these purposes.
Let me go to some more listener emails. You should be pleased, Milton, because of your role in the electric company. Lisa, one of our listeners, says, "We homeschool and love the electric company. My son, who needs to be in motion while learning, loves to dance to the lessons. He remembers every lesson and uses them in his reading." But here are some opinions. People register some thoughtful opinions, as we can expect from our listeners. Lynn says, "I would like to mention, when your guest talked about making education relevant to the real world, that we are in danger of losing opportunities for people to be reflective. With liberal arts programs being cut at universities across the country, it seems we are sacrificing the need for a certain population to be thinkers, to reflect on who we are. Yes, let's encourage real-world participation in education, but let's not forget that for eons we've learned about ourselves through philosophy, art, theology, for their own sake." And Michelle writes, "I'm very intrigued with your show today. I was just at the New American Canyon High School speaking to the principal about how to use technology as one of the many tools as you move from teacher to student-centered pedagogy. With so many new initiatives thrown at teachers, there must be adequate professional development. Using technology is one thing. Integrating it into a meaningful curriculum that fosters authentic learning is another. Being able to use the PBL model includes not only two-dimensional technology, but hands-on learning opportunities that involve real-world application of knowledge. Now we need to determine how we assess mastery of knowledge in the 21st century. Cheers to this programming." And Kathy writes, "I've been a middle school math teacher for 20 years and watched the use of technology and the internet in the classroom grow over that time. Recently, the use of smart boards have changed my teaching role in the classroom. Also, the website Mathletics is one of the best uses of the internet for math education I have seen. This website has significantly changed my students' interest in using the internet for real learning. There has been an education technology learning curve, but with these new programs, I have seen significant changes." You're familiar with that program, Tina, I take it.
I just wrote it down, yes.
Okay. Let me get Don on from Sonoma. Don, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Thank you, Michael. I want to ask specifically, you know, that does anyone ask the student what their motives are? In other words, can we use motivational interviewing from the field of addiction to find out what those motivations are? And then, two, use Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences to use the specific motives to teach other subjects. And in other words, not to lockstep into math and verbal intelligence, but to broaden the concept of teaching up and out.
Oh, yeah, I like that. I mean, I like Howard Gardner, admittedly. But, you know, we are too focused. I think we've been too focused on this whole notion of an intelligence quotient. It tends to skew verbally, and there are so many different varieties of intelligence. Some thoughts from either of you on this?
Actually, yeah. The multiple learning styles quiz at edutopia.org is one of the most popular pieces on edutopia.org, people, through that, learn that they do have different strengths. And every parent knows this if they have more than one child. I've only had one child myself. But when you have two or three kids, you know. This is something that parents know, that kids have different strengths and weaknesses, areas they need to work on, and ways in which they like to learn. So at edutopia.org, Howard Gardner's work is featured in a number of places. And we also like the idea of kids learning artistically. Gardner talks about the kinesthetic intelligence, the idea of using your body to learn. We've got a great piece on edutopia.org, and I feature it in my book, where kids learn reading through learning about opera. And if you wonder how that could be, and when I first heard about it, I wondered about that, please go to edutopia.org and look up this project from Tucson called Opening Minds Through the Arts.
Actually, I gave a talk to the Opera Guild, and boy, were they enthusiastic about that, as you might imagine. Let me try to get another caller on here, and that's John from Sacramento. Morning, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I, a number of years ago, used to be a admissions officer for UC Berkeley, and I was always fascinated by the different styles of teaching that I would see at the different high schools, whether it was private or public or charter. And, not necessarily trying to give a specific school a plug, but High Tech High in San Diego was absolutely phenomenal in this ability to be able to bridge the gap of teaching, you know, high-tech skills and computer skills and different methods of learning, but that they were also utilizing, you know, art and liberal arts. And I always find it fascinating when I would walk through that campus, it would be as if I was walking through engineering labs at Berkeley, but then I would also see art projects that, you know, were college level as well. And I know personally for myself that when I was in high school, I leaned toward the arts. It was what motivated me, but it ended up leading me to eventually a career in engineering because it allowed me to use those creative skills in ways that I wouldn't necessarily had an opportunity to do if everything was being taught to the middle ground.
Well, we got left brain, right brain again, and the necessity of teaching to both or educating with both. Do you know that school that he alluded to?
Yes, in fact, we featured it. High Tech High is pretty well known amongst those who track these things about innovative schools. But if you can, the great thing about our site at edutopia.org is you can see a film about what they do, and you can see this integration of the artistic work with the scientific work, so it doesn't have to be the arts versus the sciences.
Well, let's plug edutopia.org as well as the new KQED website covering education technology, mindshift.kqed.org, and Milton Chen's book, Education Nation, Six Leading Edges of Innovation in Our Schools. Thank you both for being with us, Milton Chen, Tina Barsagian. And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank also our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, thank you again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.